Okay, so let's do about 45 minutes of meditation. Get the day started off. And maybe 4 or 5 minutes of meditation would be better. What?
4 to 5.
Yeah, 4 to 5. I said 45 and nobody got it, so I meant really 4 to 5. But so meditation is, I know this class doesn't attract a lot of new people, but anyway, it just means the definition of meditation is basically to accustom the mind to virtue, because we all know how to meditate, you know. If we get obsessed with something, we just completely focus on it. That's not meditation. That's not what we're really talking about here. And in this particular meditation, we're going to take something that's very boring, your breath, you know, but it's always going, it's always happening. So you can focus your mind on your breath. And then, of course, when it strays off, you just bring your mind back again and again. Most people can't stay focused on their breath for very long. Because if you bring your mind back 100 times in 5 minutes, you wouldn't be surprising. Now that your mind is a bit settled, just do a brief contemplation that helps to set the motivation for being here this morning. And I'm going to, this is the Buddhist perspective, so some people are new here, and this may be a little bit different than the way you ordinarily think, but it's the Buddhist perspective on what is the purpose of your life, and the purpose, and it also gives you some idea about how we can make our lives meaningful. The purpose of life is to guide all sentient beings throughout all space and time from their present state of confusion and dissatisfaction, depression, all these things that we call dukkha, from the present state of suffering to the state of sublime, perfect happiness, blissful happiness, not just, you know, neutral happiness, but actually blissful happiness, the blissful happiness of enlightenment. So that's our job, to guide others from confusion to bliss, blissful happiness, so that they, at that point, all beings have, when we reach that state and when others do, we've achieved all of our, we've perfected compassion and wisdom and loving kindness and power and skillful means, knowing what to do to help others. We've perfected all of those qualities and eliminated all of our faults. This is what enlightenment is. This is what Buddhism posits is actually possible for each one of us. Everybody has that potential. Just needs to be nurtured. Set our sights on helping others, but to do that, we have to get our act together. We cannot help others if we're confused. We can't guide people to the top of the mountain if we don't know how to get there ourselves, if we've never been there. And Buddhism has a beautiful map. That's great, but to really get there, we need a guide. We need a guide. We need a living, breathing example of the teachings, who's actually been all the way from confusion to these higher states of consciousness that we call full enlightenment, or at least part of the way, further than we've been anyway. So, said another way, I must eliminate my faults and develop all of my qualities to the nth degree in order to be able to help others. The goal is to help others. The method to do that is to perfect oneself and eliminate one's faults, which has to do with the subject of today called pure, which is mainly purification. Purification of what? Purification of the imprints, the karmic seeds, the imprints that have been placed on our mind in the past, the ones that have been motivated by self-centeredness. Those are the ones that are always going to lead to suffering. And pretty much 24/7, that's what we do, is plant seeds motivated by self-centeredness. So lots of future problems unless we purify. It is, as the Buddha said, we can shape our mind any way we want. It's in our hands. It's in our hands to transform our mind, to change our mind. There's no external supreme being that's going to come and sprinkle fairy dust on us and we're going to wake up and everything's going to be great. It's like we have work to do. This takes effort. And it makes sense. It does take effort. So the whole path to enlightenment is a method of not only purifying negative karma, but planting the seeds that lead to supreme happiness. So we need both. We need the purification and the accumulate, what's called the accumulation of merit. And or positive karma, and these have often happened simultaneously. Like today, if we don't run out of time, we'll do a practice of purification, and that will not only give us a chance to purify actions of body, speech, and mind, but also create merit. So if you can relax your consciousness, open your eyes. And we don't have the prayer book. What are we doing this one? Let's do, this is, we don't have to, this is not, oh, here it is. So let's do some prayers. This is good. These are just, this is mainly a repetition of what I just went over. This is setting the motivation. And also, if you're a Buddhist, it distinguishes, where are the prayers, by the way? Anybody know which page they're on?
34.
34, thank you. Obviously, I don't use this book very much. Yeah, but this distinguishes someone who's a Buddhist from non-Buddhist, and within Buddhism, whether you practice for individual liberation or to liberate all sentient beings, so that's the refuge in bodhicitta prayer, and the four measurables have to do with love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And then the seven limb prayer has to do with antidotes to negative karma, pride and jealousy, and so on. So everything here has profound meaning if you understand it. Otherwise, it looks like we're just wasting our time with empty rituals. But we're not. This is meaningful if you understand it. All right, so let's read these together. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment and friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And this is a mandala offering. This is sort of, in the old days, to get teachings, even now. But traditionally in the old days, to give teachings, the students were so desperate, you might say, to get the teachings, that they would bring gold and silver and all kinds of precious things to the teacher who didn't care, because then, you know, they weren't attached to any of that stuff. But it was a symbolic offering of how, you know, this is like, I want these teachings so badly, I'll give up anything. So this is actually giving up everything in the universe. This is how, you know, the attitude that a student who's ready to learn has, is they're willing to give up everything to receive the teaching. So that's what the mandala is. It's just, imagine a symbolic universe full of all things. As Lama Yeshe used to say, just think of some like great mall like South Point, all the wonderful things out there, and just imagine you're offering it to the teachers. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha filling offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamne Yata Yami. Which translated means, offer this precious mandala to the teachers, to all the perfect gurus. Alright. That. We'll do some dedication prayers. What time is this class in, by the way? At 10 or 10:15? 10:15. Okay. I bought my props today. Anybody recognize that? What has that got to do with karma? Yeah, what goes around comes around. A boomerang, if you throw that baby. So basically, all day long, every day, we're throwing boomerangs. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. I mean, some of them are going to, you know, they'll all come back eventually. That's the point. It's kind of cold in here, isn't it? They'll all come back. Some of them will bring happiness, and some of them will bring suffering. If a boomerang comes back and it brings suffering, what kind of action was that? Was that virtuous or non-virtuous? By definition, this is the point. When that particular seed ripens, or when that action comes back to us in the form of a boomerang, if it causes suffering, then that was non-virtue. Okay? Was non-virtue. So sometimes I use crazy examples, like, I mean, some people really love to get angry. It makes them feel good. Rageaholics, you know, they get, you know, makes you feel alive. You know, when you get angry, all that adrenaline's going, and you feel, and you go, well, that's a good thing. But the consequences of raging around like that is nobody wants to be around you. The room clears out. You don't have anybody to talk to. You don't have any friends, because who wants to be around somebody like that? You know, there's just a very, you know, rages, anger, that kind of unleashed anger is pretty scary to people usually. So the same thing with, you know, a rapist. You know, that you might say, well, the rapist is having fun. In the moment, it might be a pleasurable experience for that individual, but the karmic consequences of that is enormous suffering. So even though things, you know, people seem like they're getting a charge out of something that's negative, the long-term consequences of what we're really looking at. That's what defines whether something's virtuous or non-virtuous. So anything that causes us in the long run, and we're not talking about, this is your thing, we're not just talking, as a, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, we're not just talking about this lifetime. We're talking about, it could be 10,000 eons from now, but we never get by with anything. As Venerable Rabina likes to say, no, maybe Lama Zopa says this too, karma takes care. Karma takes care. It's a big job, our biggest job in the whole life right now, is to pay attention to our karma, to police our mind 24/7, 65 times in a finger snap. It's to our advantage to pay attention and not let our mind throw the boomerangs out that are going to cause us future suffering. And I'm going to teach this a little differently than maybe some of you are used to. I was reading some stuff last night about it. I always learn, I mean everybody who teaches knows this, you always learn more when you teach, so I found this helpful. Now I could just talk about the four opponent powers and we could get out of here early, but I don't think that's right. I think we need to understand karma and how that works a little bit, and then we can talk about the four opponent powers and how to purify karma and all that good stuff toward the end. So I'm going to write down a couple of things here. These are the, when you're doing your meditation later on, and I want you to start thinking about this now, you may say, well, I've never killed anybody, or, you know, probably some insects and, you know, scorpions and you know, whatever. But, you know, and Bob the Critter comes out and fumigates your house for cockroaches once every 6 months or something like that. We've all killed something, probably not human beings, but in past lifetimes, this is just a way to think. We've done everything. We make, you know, Saddam Hussein and Adolf Hitler and Stalin, you know, look like, you know, small potatoes. We've been as evil as anybody in the world. We've killed countless beings as humans and animals and all the rest. So these are called the 10 non-virtuous actions. These are things, can you read this in the back? I tell you what, while I'm doing this, I have a few things to write down. I'd like for you to introduce yourself to two people that you don't know, or maybe you do know them, but reintroduce yourself. We'll do that for a few minutes while I do this. Purchase, killing, stealing, adultery, now some more people, introduce yourself some more, just keep talking. You can find out something about each other too, by the way. Like, you know, why are you here? Lying. Slander. Hush. Well, if we're going to purify, we might as well try to understand what it is that we're trying to purify, right? So we need to understand this. And there's several different lists here that, you know, I don't expect people who haven't studied this before necessarily to memorize them, but they're useful to memorize. So by the way, this might be a good time to, I'm not joking, this might be a good time to leave. If you don't want to, this is the Buddhist perspective, and it can be a little bit disturbing. You know, particularly when we get to the point of, hey, you're responsible for everything in your life. Everything. Everything that's ever happened to you is the fruit of your own former actions. If you were born with a birth defect on a ventilator and blah, 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 whatever that was, or something bad happened to you along the way, the Buddhist perspective is not being cruel or mean or anything like that. It's just the laws of nature. You know, sometimes I use the example, what law am I demonstrating? Gravity. Karma is just like that. It's not personal. If you do this, you get that. You do this, you get that. You do this, you get that. It's not personal. But it's very helpful to understand these laws, because when we do, we start really paying attention if you have faith in karma. Now, they say that it's some of it. I think Westerners have some general faith in karma because there's a lot of songs out there about it. You know, and people, you know, what is it? Culture Club's coming to town soon, right? So, you know, Boy George, karma, 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 karma. Anyway, but they don't understand karma like I'm getting ready to teach it. So the first one is, like makes like. Like. Now, what do I mean by that? So if you plant a watermelon seed, you're not going to get an apple, right? So this is really important to know. Positive actions, and we just defined them earlier, didn't we? We just defined positive actions. Anything that the long-term consequences of it, when that boomerang comes back, if it brings happiness, that was virtue. If it brings suffering, that was non-virtue. So positive leads to positive, negative leads to negative. Likely, so this is really important because we don't want negative. We don't want suffering. So we have to pay attention in a very precise way to actions of body, speech, and mind. Then number two is, I'm saying this in a way that's a little bit more digestible. What we usually say is karma is expandable, but what you get back is always much bigger than what you did. What you get back. This is kind of like the doubling effect of karma. Like killing, this sounds ridiculous, but just go, you know, just creatively align with this for a moment. But killing an insect today in 2 weeks from a karmic perspective is equivalent to killing a human being. Ouch. But that's what they say in the text. Like, what you get back, let's see, what get back is bigger than what you did. Bigger. This is virtuous and non-virtuous. I'm not picking on, yeah. Positive actions lead to happiness. Negative actions, non-virtuous actions, again, virtue. Virtue leads to happiness all the time, every time, because that's a seed that has to ripen sooner or later. Non-virtue always leads to suffering. What you get back is bigger than what you did. So, very cool here. But two things. Lama Atisha, who's the founder of the Kadam tradition that we're the Kadampa Center. He's the founder of that particular, where his disciples founded this particular lineage. He used to go through Tibet, and whenever he had a negative thought, he'd jump off his horse and put a little altar down with a stoop and purify right on the spot. Why? Because he knew that karma was expandable. Like that little negative karmic seed that was planted, if he didn't purify it right away, would be, you know, start like a little oak seed. It'd be like, you know, what is that that kind of photography they do where they fast forward everything, time-lapse photography. You know, you see a little seed going in the ground, and then all of a sudden, the seedling comes up, and then you see a little tree, and then, 100 years from now, you see this giant oak tree, right? Well, he could see that the tree was already growing. He could already see that that seed was already growing. So he wanted to like rip it out of the ground as quick as possible. So in the same way, the tiniest act of kindness or the tiniest act of non-virtue, like just looking at somebody with a nasty look or saying something kind of, being snappy. I like all the new words for anger. Cranky, snappy, grumpy. It's anger. That's what it is. It's anger. So that's going to always cause problems. Always those seeds will ripen. When that boomerang comes back, we won't be happy about it. Promise. That's the Buddhist perspective. All right. Then, if you don't do anything, you're not going to get anything back. This sounds stupid, doesn't it? If you don't do anything, nothing comes back. Well, what does that mean? If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. You ever heard that one? If you don't do anything, nothing comes back. Well, if you do something, it will come back. So right now, we're having an experience, aren't we? So something's coming back, even in this very moment. It's the karmic seeds planted from the Buddhist perspective again, karmic seeds planted from the past, ripening now, to force you to see yourself in Kadampa Center learning about karma. I mean, this is all, our perspective is this, there are no accidents. This is not an accident. And by the same token, so who's creating your reality? Is God creating your reality? Is it some external being? No. This is, if you don't do anything, nothing comes back. But it's saying if you do something, something will come back. And because things are always coming back, and what's mostly coming back is suffering, or as Geshe Gelug, he didn't like the word dukkha. I like the Sanskrit word dukkha, but he likes the word complications. That's his new word for dukkha. Life is, complications. So if you don't do anything, nothing comes back. If you do something, things will come back. So there's no external being out there that's creating our world. It's all our own mind. It is all our own mind. Okay. Now, if you do something, this sounds a little bit similar to that, but it's not. And this is why purification is so important. If you do something, you must get something back. Something. So these are the. So what does that mean? That's just what I've already said several times earlier. Every action, every tiny action of body, speech, and mind, 24/7, 65 times in a finger snap, is creating karma, and it will never get lost. It will always come back to it, but there's one caveat: unless we purify it, the karma of harming others and ourselves will come back to us as suffering at some point in the future. It could be that there's a little bit of a debate about this. I'm gonna I'm going to step out on the skinny branch and say that I think that, you know, Lonnie Eshe, and I've heard other teachers say, it's possible for karma to ripen in this lifetime that we create, okay? Particularly if it's heavily or very strongly reinforced, right? If it's very strongly reinforced, it could ripen in this very lifetime. Typically, you know, we think, well, you know, according to the wheel of life and how, you know, 12 interdependent links and things like that, it can take, you know, the soonest you're going to experience any karma is the next lifetime or some distant future lifetime. But it is possible for karma that's very powerfully reinforced to ripen in this lifetime. So, if we do something, we must get something back. Now, this goes for positive and negative, right? This goes for both. But the mostly, and this is something Lama Zopa talks about this, and I at first when I read it, I go, no, it's not really that way for me. I'm pretty happy. When I'm not happy, I'm mostly neutral. But when I really look at what's going on in my mind, it's all about me, I. So any action of body, speech, and mind that's motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance. Now the motivation's the key factor here. Any action motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance always leads to happiness. Any action motivated by self-centeredness, selfishness, always leads to suffering. So, when we really look at our minds carefully, and I'm asking, I don't know, I mean, everybody here could be enlightened and I'm the only one that's deluded. I don't think that's the case, but maybe it is. But pretty much 24/7 or most of the time, our motivation is not virtuous. And so, the future does not look good if we don't do some work to purify these seeds, these negative, what I call negative karmic seeds. Now, this is something that I think Venerable Rabina does a good job of talking about. I'll say one other thing too about So there are actually when we talk about karma, you know, there are these sort of effects of karma that happen, the big time effects of a karmic seed. So a karmic seed is a complete karmic, what we call a complete karma. It can ripen in multiple different ways. For example, you get back the same thing you gave. What you put out comes back to you. You experience a result similar, I'm saying it same thing in different ways. You experience a result similar to the cause. So if you yell at somebody and they yell back at you, that's a result similar to the cause, right? Not surprising. If you kill somebody, you just created the causes to be killed. Right? If you do something kind and are generous, you create the causes to be Bill Gates. I don't know what Bill Gates did when he was a kid, but in a former lifetime, Warren Buffett and all the people in the world that are extremely wealthy had to have practiced generosity in the past according to these laws of karma. So you get back what you gave. Doing it becomes a habit. So we have there was a movement, and maybe not so much anymore. I mean, I think in psychology, I'm not a psychologist, so probably something here but there was a movement in psychology back in the 80s of like, get it out, you know. If you're angry, you should express it. My kids are really good at doing this. And it doesn't actually get rid of it. It just builds up the habit of getting angry. So it just becomes a habit. So killing becomes a habit. Stealing can become a habit. Kindness can become a habit. Compassion, generosity, all the things that are Good. So the more we practice, you know, the fruit of it is, you know, the way this karma thing works is, the more if you do something over and over again, you just get better at it. And so expressing your anger or expressing your, you know, feelings are one thing. Feelings are just feelings. They're just like smoke coming up out of a smokestack. They really don't mean anything. It's when you have an unpleasant feeling and then you feel like you've got to strike out at whoever's around you to blame it on somebody. You know, that's not helpful. So, you know, reacting to our feelings and expressing them and the negative stuff that causes problems for us and others, that doesn't get rid of it. It just builds up the habit to do it over and over again. This is useful to know. This is useful to know. We need to stop it. All right, then it says, what you do creates the world and the people around you. So this is another thing about karma. Like, the fruit of the karma, some people think, well, karma's, oh, well, yeah, okay, it has to do with my interpretation of reality. This really is a whiteboard, and these are walls over here, and these are people around me, and blah, blah, blah. And I alluded to this earlier, but karma, this law of nature that Buddhism's talking about, is like it creates everything in our world. It creates everything in our world. It's the reason you're a man or a woman, whether you're wealthy or not, where you are right this minute, which is at Kadampa Center, listening to me and, you know, whatever I'm saying, this nonsense. You know, our whole world is created by our former actions. Not just our interpretation of it, but actually the world we live in and how it shows up for us. And then the last is, it also creates the world that we step into. So when you die at the end of this lifetime, your next life is going to be determined by karma, particularly the karma at the time of death. So this is very useful to know, because generally speaking, when we die, the habits that we've built up are going to be the ones that are. If we've spent our life cultivating peace and, you know, sort of tranquility and positive states of mind, as we're dying, we're much more likely to be able to access that state of mind and not freak out. Freaking out leads to a future rebirth that is not going to be very happy. We call it, you'll be reborn, again, this is Buddhist cosmology 101 that we're not going to talk about right now, but you'll be reborn in a joyless realm. Let's put it that way, to make it, you know, digestible. But it'll be a very difficult future lifetime. Alright? And the future lifetime with somebody who dies with a peaceful mind and a happy mind and is being reminded by their friends and their teachers to, you know, practice Tonglin and think of others and be compassionate. Die with that kind of mind, future rebirth, very positive. So it actually creates the next world. So karma, the point I am making is that karma is a big deal. It is the biggest deal in Buddhism. So, and it really means that we can shape our future by the decision. It's not predestination. I used to be a Presbyterian, and I don't know much about it, but predestination was a big part of it. And it's not that. It's like we have, by the choices we make, we can shape our future. It'll either be either a positive or negative. It'll be happiness or it'll be suffering. We can either do the actions that ripen into future happiness so that we literally are forced to see ourselves as being blissfully happy. I would like to have that. I don't want to have karma ripen that forces me to see myself as miserable. So this is a big deal. Alright, so I'm gonna, this is something that Venerable Rabina talks about. And I was trying to illustrate, thinking about how I might illustrate this today. But this is as good as I can do. So let's just say we got this plot of land here, and we got this little plot of land, and you've got these. This is green, is like a nice green plant, okay? This growing here. I got a few of them. And then, and these plants all come from seeds, karmic seeds. But let's see, in this little plot of land, we got a lot of negative karma. These are weeds. Any gardeners here? Everybody knows what I'm talking about. How easy is it going to be for those plants to thrive in a garden full of weeds? It's not going to be easy, is it? So if we want our positive karma to have an opportunity to thrive, we've got to pull these weeds out. We have to get them out. Now, sorry, I don't mean that. We don't have to do anything. We can just go along, pretend like there's no karma. You know, in this culture, I think, and I don't think I'm being critical. I think I'm pretty accurate. Most people in this culture think that there's no future life. There's no karma. But if you get by with it, you got by with it. Now a lot of people are ethical because they understand at some level that if they're mean and nasty, they get treated that way. And they don't want that. But most people don't have a really deep, profound understanding of karma like we're describing here. It's like, I'm a good person, do the best I can, and then I die, I disappear. And that's the end of that. And from the Buddhist perspective, it's not that way at all. We don't disappear. Every moment of every day, we're planting seeds that will ripen in the future according to the laws of karma. It's never lost. So what we need to do, if we want to be happy, is we need to learn how to purify. And this is not a small deal. We got to get rid of these weeds. Some of them anyway. So purification practice in Buddhism has to do with weakening and sometimes even being able to completely eliminate. The only way we can completely eliminate a negative karma is to understand emptiness and really apply that to our lives and to our choices. But at least during purification practice, we can take those karmic seeds and burn them so that those seeds won't thrive. And maybe even they won't even germinate. That's what we're trying to do in purification practice. So, any questions about this? I was going to say, since I've talked a lot, keep your questions to the end, but that's not right. I will. We're almost to the end anyway. So, any questions about this? This is really kind of interesting to me. It's a Buddhist worldview. You don't have to buy it. Lama Zopa did say one thing one time, I'm not supposed to say these things, but I'm going to say it anyway. He said, look, this is the first course I ever did in Buddhism, which is a long time ago. And he said, somebody was asking him, well, this is, are you sure this is right? And his answer was sort of, as I recollect, was something like this. If you live your life as if this were the truth, you will be happy. You will find that you will be happier and happier and happier. And if you ignore it, you know what you're going to get, which is more of the same. More of the same. And so, he said, and basically Buddhism has always been an invitation. Check it out. Buddha said, hey, check it out for yourself. See if it works. Put this kind of thinking into your brain and into your heart and start living as if every action of your body, speech, and mind will come back to you as happiness or suffering. And virtue creates happiness, and non-virtue creates suffering. Just go like that. Give it a shot for a month. See what happens. See if it hurts you or it helps you. But 2,500 years of experience is going to tell you that it will work if you do it with the proper motivation. Motivation is crucial in karma, because if I practice, if I go outside and put a check for $10,000 in the donation box, and I write the check, and I want everybody, hey, look, I'm putting, you know, I want everybody to see that I'm, by the way, if you want to make a check for $10,000, I think Dr. Watkins over here would be very happy to yeah. But if you're doing it, because for, you know, to get other people's approval and not for selfless reasons, that the motivation is tainted. It's still virtuous, but it's tainted. So the fruit of that action is not as great. There's all kinds of stuff about karma. I can't go into it right now, but the motivation is the key feature in karma. All right, now I'm going to erase this, and I'm going to go to the four opponent powers here. Okay, so this is how we... Any Catholics in here? Drop cats, yeah. I hear drop cats, recovering cats, you know, former cats. I don't. It's okay. Whatever. What now? Okay. They caught you before the age of reasoning. Okay, I understand. That's what we're trying to do here at Kadampa Center too. Oh, by the way, this is a form of purification. Is a form of brainwashing. Anybody have a problem with getting their brain washed? Yeah. What we're washing out is negative karma, though. Brainwashing is a bad connotation, doesn't it? But, gosh, I want my brain washed. I want my... What?
We're washing it ourselves.
Yeah, and we're doing it ourselves. We're going to use our mind to purify our mind. How cool is that? All right, so here are the four laws... I told you that in Buddhism there's so many great lists. Love them. This is the four powers or whatever. And I could make this simple. Sometimes I'll put the R's in here. I'm gonna put down reliance, but that doesn't mean anything to me. You know, well, it does. It means reliance on Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and compassion of bodhicitta, okay? But I'm going to say it differently. I'm going to say, think about the Dharma and remember where things come from. All right. This is fun. This one's good. This one's good. Think about the Dharma. All right? The second one is... strong decision to stop this seed before it multiplies inside you. Call this, you know, when Robbie teaches about karma, you know, we call this the power of regret. Those of you who've been to confession, you know what that is, right? The strong decision, is that right? To stop, yeah, regret. So we call that regret. The promise to not make the same mistake again. Promise to not do it again. We call that the resolve. I'm trying to, you know, because this is what it means. It means promise not to do it again. And then to do something positive. Do something. I'm just going to put a positive. To balance the karma. To balance. Now, do we need to apply these powers to positive karma? Please don't. We don't want to regret doing positive actions, do we? That's not skillful. So the power of the remedy. This is what we call the remedy. All right, but you have to understand what these words mean. So the power of the remedy. So let me say a few words about each one of these, and then we'll actually do it. Do we have time to do a practice? A little bit, yeah. So the first one, is like. So remember the Dharma and remember Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Bodhicitta. It's called a relax, but it doesn't help me. It's not easy to figure out what that means in practical terms when I'm doing a purification practice. So, it really, at some level, it means understanding what you're doing and why you're doing it. What is the Dharma? What is the Dharma trying to teach me? So here's what I'm. This is a, let me get my cell phone because I like this as a good example. Alright. Lumbago. I'm working, I need to see my chiropractor, but I don't have one. Anyway, so what is this? This is more detail than we needed, but yeah. It's a cell phone, isn't it? Now, is it? I have no idea. I don't keep, it could be. The six is the big one, right? Anyway, whatever. It is a cell phone, right? You recognize that. Why do you know it's a cell phone?
Because I have one too.
Well, but you've seen them before, right? Something happened in the last 10 to 15 years or 20 years where things like this popped up. When I don't think Steve Jobs was still around when this one was made, but as soon as this one showed up in the store, you knew it was an iPhone 5. Before that, you had no idea, but let's even go back before that. 30 years ago, if I'd have held this thing up, what would you call it? A black box with a screen on it. And some color, but you wouldn't know. You wouldn't have the seed that says this is a cell phone. So we know it's a cell phone. So baby comes in the room and, crawls in here like a, they start walking around once. So about a 7 or 8 month old baby comes in here and it's on the floor and they see it and they do what with it? They play with it. They might put it in their mouth. They play with it, right? So what's it to the baby? A toy. Now, is the baby deluded? No. The baby's right. It's a toy to the baby. Now, to us, it's an iPhone. Does everybody agree with this? We got any dissenters here? All right, good. So this is important. This is the key to your life, to my life, to happiness, to understanding all of Tibetan, all of Buddhism. The Buddhist input, it comes down to this. What did you say?
An iPhone.
Exactly. Just hold on, Robbie. Just hold that thought. So everybody, including the baby, leaves the room. What is it then? This is the big question. What is it? Hello? I need some help here, people. It's nothing. Well, it exists. It's a black, we can all agree that it's black, but it's nothing. That's true. But, it's for its very existence, it depends upon the process of labeling. That's pretty cool. That's pretty interesting. The fact that the baby
and the adult see the same object but have a different experience of it and a different label for it, depends upon their what? Their karma. Their seeds ripening. The baby sees it as a playful, as an object to play with. That's the karmic seed that ripens when the baby sees it. And when we see it, it looks like something to talk on and text on and play with. It's a cell phone. So our experience of this object, of our entire life, is the product of what? Former actions. Karmic seeds. So one way to think about it is this. It's like, now this is just a convenient way to think about it. It's as if there's a blank screen. We're going to the movie theater. There's a blank screen. And where's the projector coming from? Now, when I see cell phone, let me give it to you this way. When I see cell phone, is cell phone coming from the object of the cell phone, or is it coming from my mind labeling cell phone? Is it coming this way, or is it going this way? Where is it coming from? If it was a truly a cell phone, the baby would pick it up and talk on it. So there's no cell phone that exists independent of my mind labeling it, right? Is that clear? There's nothing. So our entire world exists independent upon the process of labeling it. And so it's as if, and I'm not talking about just interpretation of reality here. I'm talking about the very fact that this exists depends upon karma. The very fact that everything in this room, including the walls, the people, everything is karma. So it's as if there's a blank slate and our karma is ripening. Again, 65 mind moments in a finger snap are ripening. Seeds are popping up to have us experience our life. And in this moment, the people are in this room. It's the karma for experiencing being at Kadampa Center, having a pleasant or unpleasant or neutral experience, whatever you're labeling it, but it's our own former actions ripening, forcing us to have an experience of reality. Well, that's because we share some common karma. We can call it group karma, but we're all having a very unique experience. Some people are bored. Some people have gotten up and left. We're all having a different experience. Yeah, we're all having the same experience of being in the room, but we're having our own unique experience of everything. That's the whole point. Our whole life is of our own creation, depending on our own individual karma and the fruition of karma. So getting back to the whole point of today, the point of this is to purify the karma that causes us to suffer, to get the weeds out of the garden, and so that more of these positive seeds can ripen. So that's the reliance part, or remembering the Dharma. The second one is regret. And this probably is, I've read, this is a meditation that we really need to do. Probably the most important part of all of the four punnet powers is to sit down and review your life. And sometimes it's really not pleasant. You know, is to go back and look at your life from the time you were a kid all the way through your crazy teenage years and beyond, and things will come up. And this is where we bring up the negativity to purify it so we can create happiness, right? So this seems a little, this may be a little troublesome to people, but the result of this is pleasant feelings. We bring in up bad memories and negative things that we go, and particularly helpful to bring up things that make you cringe, like, oh my God, did I do that? Ugh, I wish I hadn't done that. So we want to bring up stuff, actions of body, speech, and mind. And these 10 non-virtues are just guidelines. You know, there are 84,000 delusions, and, you know, it could be anything that we've done that has left a negative karmic residue. We want to bring it to mind. We want to bring it, like confession, kind of in the Catholic perspective, it's sort of like bring it into the light of day. Bring it up. Don't be afraid of it, because we can let it go. That's the whole point. Then the result is we, and this is also very important. When my kids misbehave, I don't do it as much now as I used to, but I'd say, okay, now why have you had this time out? I don't know. All right, you want to go back in time out? Okay, for talking mean to you and hitting so-and-so. And I say, okay, now can you promise not to do it again? Even for just an hour. Okay, I won't do it for an hour. This is real important. We have to, you know, in AA and some of those recovery programs, they say one day at a time, you know. So we don't want to lie about it. If you have a tendency towards some negativity, just try to say 5 minutes or 10 minutes or an hour or a day. Or sometimes you can say blanket statements like, as much as possible, I'm not going to do this ever again in my lifetime. I know I have a tendency toward that, but I'm really going to be vigilant about, like, not taking another drink, or not doing this, not doing drugs, or, you know, whatever, or not getting angry at my spouse, or not being mean, whatever. And then the last thing is the remedy, and it could be anything. If you've been mean to somebody, if you've been disrespectful to somebody, don't, you know, you can come to Kadampa Center and walk around the stupa all day, and that's great and creates a lot of merit. But, you know, picking up the phone and saying, I'm really sorry that I did that. I apologize from the bottom of my heart, and I promise that I will not do, you know, as much as possible, I'm not going to do that again to you ever. I'm so remorseful about that. So any action, it could be, you know, going to the, any positive action doesn't necessarily have to be Vajrasattva mantra or doing prostrations or doing some Buddhist practice, although Buddhism is replete with these wonderful purification practices, including walking around the stupa, imagining white light as you do that, going through your body and purifying negativity of your body, speech, and mind. You can do that. But picking up the phone and actually doing something about it is very, very helpful. So it's, you know, and I think, again, and some of my friends that have been in recovery programs, I think part of the thing is you take an inventory of your life, and then you go back and you call us, you know, of course, to some people you wouldn't want to call, but you try to make it right. You try to clean it up, you know? You try to make it right so you don't have to experience the karmic fruit of that negative action. So we're out of time. Don't have to have time to do it, but here's a little practice that you can do at home with these four planet powers. And I'm going to write this mantra down because it's very easy to do. Now, if you have, you know, if you want to do this practice at home, well, first of all, the four planet powers, do call the people up that you've, or talk to the people that you have some remorse or some kind of negative energy on. And by the way, the most powerful people in your life from a karmic perspective are who? Your teachers and who? Your family, your mother, your dad. Those are the people that you probably have the most negativity on, but positivity too, maybe. But a lot of people don't get along with their parents, but those are the most powerful karmic forces. So those are the people that it's really good to practice virtue. They can be the object of your virtuous practice. But this mantra, which is really easy to memorize, there's a 100-syllable version of it, but if you do this 28 times at night before you go to bed, you purify, you at least weaken the force of all the negative karma that you did that day. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Sounds like a, you know, like an advertisement. Even I can remember this one. This PAT is not fat. Om Vajrasattva Humpe. Om Vajrasattva Humpe. Om Vajrasattva Humpe. So you sit down on your meditation cushion, and let's do this for like 1 minute. I'll tell you what to do. The people can wait outside for a couple more minutes. So sit up straight, and I'm going to suggest that you imagine an orb of white light above your head that's powerful, like a billion times more powerful than the sun. And we're going to call that orb of light Vajrasattva. And white has a is the color, or it's not a color, is it? But it's like, it symbolizes purity. That's why we, you know, all the brides wear white dresses, I guess. And so white symbolizes purity. We all recognize that. So we're going to imagine that that white light is going to come through us, and it's going to purify all the negative karma. It's above our head. It's going to come right into us, and it's going to completely fill us with white light. And it's going to purify the negative karma of body, speech, and mind. I'm not going to try to do any, there are more detailed visualizations, but we're not going to do that. Just do it, do this now. And before you do it, though, bring to mind something, a couple of things. Don't try to get too, you know, some things that you have a negative charge on, something that's kind of disturbing your mind at the moment. And that light above the crown of your head is your mind. It's not separate from your mind, and it symbolizes this incredible power that we're labeling Vajrasattva. It symbolizes an object that can help us purify negative karma. And you have to, it's good to have some, just have some faith. This is where faith comes in, that this is actually going to work. And you're going to be able to lessen the force of the negativity by doing this practice. And now, silently to yourself, you know, I want you to visualize as you say the mantra Om Vajrasattva Humpe Om Vajrasattva silently to yourself as quick as you can go Om Vajrasattva Humpe Om Vajrasattva Humpe Om Vajrasattva Humpe. Say it, you want to say it so that only you can hear it, not the people sitting next to you. Say that and visualize that this white light is just like a torrent, like a waterfall, just flushing you. All the negativities of body, speech, and mind are just completely, instantly disappear forever. So let's do this for just a minute. This white light coming in, purifying our body, speech, and mind. And now imagine and now you're completely pure. Think to yourself that I'm purified. got to have some sense of conviction or faith that the force of your negative karma has been eliminated. And imagine that orb of light, which we're calling Vajrasattva, melts through the crown of your head and completely fills you. And now your body, speech, and mind are inseparably one with the purity of Vajrasattva. Again, you know, you want to feel that you've been purified, that you're not hampered by this negative karma anymore. Okay, thank you. So let's do the dedication verses. What page are those on? Can't remember. May all beings plagued by the suffering to body and mind. It's like, I'm sorry? 247. Yeah, the Shanti Deva's prayer. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness enjoyed by virtue of my merit. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid of a little with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So what do we just do with this prayer? We just planted a bunch of seeds, didn't we? We just planted a bunch of seeds. These are virtuous seeds, so they will ripen and future happiness. And the last thing I want to say is that we want to, you know, we want to pray for the long life of our precious teachers who are examples of the teachings, you know. And unfortunately, you can't be homeschooled in Buddhism. You know, the point of Buddhism is that when the living examples of the teachings are no longer a present, then they're dead. They're in books, but they're dead. There's nothing, we don't have the inspiration and the power of the word of the living teachers. So we want to pray that our teachers, our lamas, Geshe Gelug and Lama Zopa, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Khyentse Rinpoche and all the teachers that teach valid paths to be free of suffering and find happiness have long lives, and that we have a long life so that we can practice the Dharma and purify our mind and develop our qualities so we can be of maximum benefit to others. So that's the gist of a dedication. Thank you. Yeah. Oh yeah, there's a retreat coming up in 2 weeks, a little less than 2 weeks now, at Avila Retreat Center. It's a Vajrasattva retreat, and it goes like Friday night, all day Saturday, and then Sunday morning. And so it's a very, for people who have, you know, a real sense of faith in karma and a desire to purify karma, this is really where the rubber meets the road. This is a fantastic opportunity to practice in an intense way. But as Lama Yeshe said, going to retreat shouldn't be thought of as like drudgery. We should think of it as like going to a nightclub. But it'll be work. There'll be some work involved, because We don't have to work with our mind. But we're going to use our mind to purify our mind, and the point is so we don't have to suffer, which is a good cause. Okay, thank you.